Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Happy Friday! And to help you celebrate, today I have a brand new show for you, which has just come out from under the 60-day embargo period during which our participating newspapers have exclusive rights. So thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on March 2nd of 2025 under the headline, Real Life Film Noir Femme Fatale Got Her Lover to Murder Her Husband. Here we go. The newlyweds, Alvin and Gladys, were on a little vacation at the Big Chief Auto Court in Truckee, California. They may have thought of it as their honeymoon when they went out together to the local cinema to see The Postman Always Rings Twice. It was September of 1946, so this was the old film noir version starring Lana Turner. As you'll surely remember if you've seen it or a more recent remake of it, this is a film in which Turner's character, Cora Smith, seduces a drifter named Frank and convinces him to murder her husband for her so that the two of them can take over ownership of his restaurant. After the film, Gladys was in a pensive mood as she turned to Alvin, the eager 23-year-old cowboy she'd married in Reno a day or two before. "It's too bad something like that can't happen to the doctor," she remarked to him innocuously. By the doctor, she meant Dr. Willis Broadhurst, prominent Jordan Valley rancher and chiropractor, and her other husband. Or rather, one of her other husbands. At that particular moment, Gladys, the strikingly pretty and charismatic 40-year-old, was married to three different men, and there were four additional failed marriages in her rearview mirror. If there was anyone for whom the wedding bells sounded like the alarm clock, or maybe they sounded like funeral bells, because a month later, Alvin actually did it. Gladys Ralphs Broadhurst was born in 1906 to a Mormon family in southern Idaho. She married her first husband, William Hendricks, when he was 20. It lasted less than a year, and then she tried again with a man named Albert Richardson the following year. That match didn't take either. Again, less than a year. So she spent the rest of her 20s single, as a touring musician. She played piano and accordion and sang with her family combo, the Ralph's Novelty Orchestra. At age 32, she tried again with a man named Carol Anderson and moved with him to Westwood, California. And again, the following year, to a man named Virgil Warner, with whom she moved to Medford. Neither of these marriages lasted more than a year either. Gladys sure could catch him, but she couldn't seem to keep him. That was until Lieutenant Leslie M. Lincoln came into her life. Leslie was only 24 years old, and by now Gladys was 11 years older than that, so she was kind of robbing the cradle with this one. The two of them tied the knot in January of 1942, the month after Pearl Harbor was attacked, and every expectation was that the lieutenant would be shipped out soon on short notice, which actually did happen later that year. According to Patrick Gallagher, Gladys's rather merciless biographer and the grandson of the man who would later be her lead defense attorney, it was about this time that Gladys got addicted to sedatives, specifically Nembutal, pentobarbital, a.k.a. yellow jackets or goofballs, which was a barbiturate that she started taking to treat insomnia and got hooked on. By the end of the decade, she'd be gulping down 1,400 to 2,000 milligrams of the stuff each day, 7 to 10 times the normal dose, and spending a lot of time sleeping. She seems to have been happy as Leslie's wife until he came back home. After that, the marriage went sour pretty fast. By the summer of 1945, it must have been pretty clear that she was on track for divorce number 4. But by then, Gladys likely no longer cared because 2 months before, she'd reconnected with an old flame and was exchanging torrid letters with him. Her new old beau was a man she'd flirted with in the old touring musician days, a young chiropractor named Willis Broadhurst, better known as W.B. or Dr. Broady. Dr. Broady, when she'd first met him, was not a wealthy man. He was just starting out and struggling to establish a practice. But he had since done very well, and now, 20 years later, he was a rancher with a couple of big spreads in Idaho and Oregon and a thriving practice. So she reached out with a telegram to see if he might be worth reconnecting with. And yes, he sure was. His marriage to another woman had ended in divorce 4 years earlier. So she found him rich and single and eager to reconnect with the woman he considered an old flame. Their letters got more and more torrid. She told him she was a war widow, her husband, Leslie, having been killed in London during an air raid. She also told him that she was in the process of inheriting $3 million from an aunt to allay any suspicion that she was gold digging. And to guard against the possibility of Leslie getting wise and spilling the beans, she told Dr. Brody that she was being stalked by Leslie's evil twin, Lester, who was impersonating his dead brother and trying to force himself upon her with an eye toward grabbing her inheritance. Which was pretty clever, you have to admit. And between that and the fact that the woman dishing up this whopper was someone he considered to be not only the hottest woman he'd ever dated, but one of his oldest friends to boot, we can't be too hard on him for lapping it right up, which of course he did. A couple months later, in a letter, she suggested the two of them ought to get married. And so, on May 20th, 1946, the two of them met up in Reno, pulled a marriage license, and the following day were bigamously married. Months went by. Gladys and Dr. Brody kept their marriage a secret, ostensibly to avoid trouble with the evil twin brother, but really to give Gladys time to get divorced from Leslie. But a few months after the marriage, Leslie intercepted one of Dr. Brody's letters, along with one from his sister, and that escalated things a bit. Gladys couldn't drive, so she had to come up with a story that would bring Dr. Brody on the run to rescue her. So she came up with a yarn about having blood poisoning in her foot and a potential looming amputation. Dr. B, of course, dropped everything and raced to the scene. He picked her up and brought her home in his fancy cream-colored 1941 Chevrolet Deluxe Coupe. Well, that was great. Among other things, Dr. Brody was able to get her into the hospital to get her barbiturate addiction treated. He seems to have accepted that the drugs were the source of the blood poisoning story, as there is no further reference to it. But a few weeks later, the sheriff tried to serve papers on Gladys, and she realized that those papers probably were divorce proceedings, and wondered what would happen when her second husband realized she was still married to her first and had lied about the evil twin brother. Nothing good. She knew she had to act. So she told Dr. Brody she needed to go back to Sacramento and take care of some business connected with her pending inheritance. It was harvest season, so he couldn't go along. Instead, he paid a young ranch hand $5 a day plus expenses to go along with her to California and do the driving. That young ranch hand, just 23 years old, was named Alvin Williams. And a week or so later, there he was, watching The Postman Always Rings Twice with the hottest woman he'd ever dated, who had initiated a torrid, adulterous affair with him on the second night of their road trip. Down in Sacramento, Gladys accepted service of the amended divorce decree. It started a clock running, which would end in a final decree on October of the following year, and then Gladys and Leslie would be legally divorced, and she'd be down to two husbands again, because, of course, by that time, she and Alvin had stopped by a wedding chapel in Reno, and Gladys, under a fake name, had married him too. Then she and husband number three returned to husband number two's ranch in Jordan Valley. I'm sure you can see this is going nowhere good. A few days later, Dr. Brody was getting ready to go out for his annual elk hunting trip. Gladys told him she was very nervous. He would be out of pocket for days, riding on the range. What if something should happen to him, she asked. Her $3 million inheritance was still in probate. She wouldn't even have enough ready money to cover funeral expenses. She told him she was dreadfully worried about him, almost frantic, and worried that if he got killed out on the range, she would be left hanging in the wind. So the unsuspecting Dr. Brody went to his attorney's office and had a new will drafted and approved, leaving his entire estate to her. There now, he said, don't you feel better now? I'm sure she did, and he continued with his preparations for the hunting trip. Meanwhile, Gladys and Alvin were spending a lot of time together. They discussed various ways of putting Dr. Brody out of the way, now that the will had been changed. She had brought him fully on board with her Postman Always Rings Twice plan by telling him vivid stories of Dr. Brody's cruelty, and the poor love-struck young dolt does not seem to have ever questioned it. They decided he would ambush Dr. Brody on the highway north of Jordan Valley as he was driving to the ranch with his pinto horse and a trailer behind. She gave Alvin $200 to buy an old Model A to use to do it, since, of course, everybody knew Dr. Brody's Chevrolet by sight. Alvin, equipped with his bedroll and a single-barrel Stevens 12-gauge shotgun and half a gallon of whiskey, drove out to the intersection of the ION Highway, that's Idaho-Oregon-Nevada Highway, and Sucker Creek Road, pulled over, and opened the hood. The plan was to get Dr. Brody to stop and try to help fix the car. Then, when he was leaning over the engine, Alvin would crack his canister for him with a big crescent wrench that he'd picked out of the toolbox, and if that didn't work, a dose of birdshot from a few feet away should finish the doctor off. Then he'd drag the corpse into the brush and hide it, get rid of the shotgun, and hide the Model A someplace until the coast was clear. And well, yeah, that's basically how the crime went down. But because nobody involved in this operation was very smart, the conspirators didn't take some important things into account. The first was that if you're in Jordan Valley, then as now, if you're pulled off the road with your hood up, everybody who drives by is going to stop and try to help you. And yeah, there isn't much traffic out there, but if you're sitting there all morning and afternoon, eventually somebody will drive by and stop and ask if you need help. That somebody will think it's really weird when you say no, your buddy has gone into town for some car parts and will be right back, but you're still there 4 hours later when he drives back through. And of course, he will remember you and your car in some detail when he learns someone got murdered at that very location a few hours after he passed by the second time. Yeah, that did happen. The second thing is this. How do I put this delicately? Never mind, here goes. If you're 23 and sleeping with the boss's wife, everybody knows. You might think you're being real discreet, but you're 23. You wouldn't know discreet if it got drunk and punched you in the nose. Everybody on the ranch knows what you're doing, and when the boss turns up murdered, it will occur to them that statistically, people who don't take the seventh commandment very seriously are a little less likely to be sticklers for the sixth. And the third thing is, when a man's horse shows up at his house without him, everyone goes straight into search and rescue mode, which of course they did. And then they found Dr. Brody's pickup and horse trailer later that night, and the good Samaritans who stopped and talked to Alvin remembered him and told the sheriff, and... There's an interesting moment in the newspaper coverage of this crime, which appears to capture the precise moment when Gladys realized her goose was cooked. Caldwell Fire Chief Lionel Crawl said about 5 a.m. Tuesday, October 15th, he called the defendant again, the Oregonian's Ron Moxness wrote in the March 1st edition. I asked her if she had heard anything about Doc, Crawl said, and she said she wanted to know if we had found anything. I told her about the trailer, and the conversation stopped. I thought the connection had broken, but she returned to the phone and said she had been alone and nervous and hadn't slept well. Then Alvin broke down and confessed the whole thing and led police to the wash where he'd hidden the body and the shotgun. Well, the trial that ensued was probably the most sensational case Malheur County had ever seen. The evidence against Gladys was mostly circumstantial, but there was a lot of it, and it was very damning indeed, including, interestingly enough, her very presence in the courtroom during the trial.
For 2 long weeks, you have observed her charm and her magnetism, District Attorney Charles Swan told the jury. I think it has made itself felt on every person she has met. If you can see and feel the impact of such a person in a proceeding such as this, I ask you to imagine, if you can, the effect on a youth who has lived with her for many weeks.
Alvin, Swan said, fell under the spell of that magnetism and became her obedient slave.
Without Gladys Broadhurst, Swan added grimly, there would have been no murder.
Not so, riposted Gladys's attorney, Patrick Gallagher, the grandfather of her biographer. He told the jury that yes, his client was a double bigamist, a morally bankrupt habitual drug abuser steeped in carnal sin, but that didn't make her a murderess.
Gallagher argued that the love affair with Alvin had blown up and that Williams was on his way out when he murdered the doctor to get back to her again, reporter Moxley wrote in one of his Oregonian stories.
The jury didn't buy it. She was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. The sentence was controversial. Most Oregonians really wanted her to swing for the job.
Some of our brethren of the press are complaining about Mrs. Broadhurst escaping the death sentence and are blaming it on the jury which convicted her,
wrote the editor of the Corvallis Gazette-Times in a March 17, 1947 editorial.
Perhaps the jury was convinced by the same thing that got for Mrs. Broadhurst her 7 husbands.
It does seem likely, but her lenient sentence probably saved Alvin's life, because as the judge pointedly said, it would offend justice to have him punished more severely than the person who set him in motion to do her will. In any case, Alvin drew the same sentence, life in prison, but his conviction was for second-degree murder rather than first. And life in prison turned out to be a little under 10 years for Gladys, and a little over that for Alvin. Gladys was paroled out of the joint in August of 1957, Alvin the following spring. Alvin married a woman named Nina Cantrell 2 years after his release and settled into family life, raising a family with her in Idaho. He died in 2010. As for Gladys, she apparently kept her nose clean for the requisite several years after her release, but she also reached out to an old flame from the Sacramento days, a man named Leo O'Shea, more or less following the same playbook that brought her back to Dr. Broadhurst. And in May of 1961, probably because that was the end of Gladys's term of parole, which would have been 5 years, O'Shea came to Salem, and the two of them got married. She moved with him to Sacramento and apparently lived in contentment with him until her death in 1973. Apparently, when it came to husbands for Gladys, 8 was enough. And they must have gotten along pretty well because after she died, he laid her to rest in the family cemetery plot with a grave marker made that read Gladys O'Shea, 1906 to 1973, John O'Shea, 1903 to blank, with a space for his own date of death to be carved in when that time came. So, what makes Gladys Ralph's such a fascinating character study? Maybe it's because she was almost a textbook example of a character type that everyone assumes doesn't exist outside of motion pictures, the classic film noir femme fatale. The beautiful, ice-cold temptress who is willing to pull any trigger, seduce any man to get what she wants, and is serenely untroubled by pangs of conscience. Like Bridget O'Shaughnessy from The Maltese Falcon, or Phyllis Dietrichson from Double Indemnity, or Catherine Trammell from Basic Instinct, or Cora Smith, Lana Turner's character from The Postman Always Rings Twice. It's still weird to contemplate Gladys there in the theater watching that movie and interpreting it not as a horrible warning but as a shining example of how to get her paws on her new husband's money before he gets wise to her. In the movie, of course, Cora's story ends badly for her, with her death in a car crash, and Frank, the drifter she vamps into murdering her husband, is sent to the gas chamber for killing her. In classic films noir, the kind that were popular in 1946, the femme fatale always comes to a bad end. Often she's killed, sometimes she's sent to the gas chamber, but never, in a classic film noir, does the murderess actually win. She does not inherit $800,000 from the man she vamped and murdered, serve a brief term in lady jail, move to another state, and start a new life with her 8th husband as a respectable society lady, dying of old age many years later at the end of a long and apparently contented life. Gladys did, though. Dr. Brody's sisters contested the will that she conned him into making a week before she had him killed, and despite state law being very clear that she wasn't entitled to collect, the sisters cut a deal with her, probably just to get her out of their lives. They gave her roughly 1/3 of the estate, clear title to the Jordan Valley Ranch. It was sold for $51,000, which was the equivalent of just over $800,000 today. Of course, her legal bills ate up a lot of this. A few years after her trial ended, her attorneys built a new office building in Ontario, and local residents took to calling it the Broadhurst Building. But there has to have been some dough left over, probably a lot. It's not clear what she did with it. Maybe she used it to purchase a new husband. And hey, yeah, about that husband. He seems to have been happy with her as a wife, but when he finally died in 1985, he was not buried with her in the family plot. The space on the gravestone for his date of death was left blank, and the grave unfilled. Instead, the family purchased a new plot in a cemetery a mile or two away and laid their loved one to rest in it alone, where they could lay flowers on his grave without also leaving them on hers. Key sources in this story included works by Patrick Gallagher, Philip Drew, and the archives of the Portland Morning Oregonian. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I do hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do, or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. If you haven't already, check out our Offbeat Oregon books. They're basically revised, updated, and re-researched collections of these columns and podcasts arranged by topic. So far, we've done Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, and Bad Ideas and Horrible People of Old Oregon. Nuts, Cranks, and Colorful Characters of Old Oregon is scheduled to come out this summer sometime. By the way, if you found this article interesting, you probably would enjoy Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, so you should check it out. Keep in mind, though, that it was published before I knew that this story existed, so this story's not in there. But these books you can find in hardcover, softcover, and ebook, wherever you get your reading materials, or, you know, on Amazon, etc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra of Seattle. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes come out once per weekday, usually around 6 a.m. So it won't be long before the next episode is on your device and ready for you to queue up and enjoy. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.